Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order at 3:06 p.m. Trying to help wake up Representative Vance a little bit. Well, Martha, will you please call the roll?
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative LeDoux?
Here.
Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Wolf? Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Fields? Representative Price Tompkins?
Here. With five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Representative Fields is presenting the Pioneer Home Fees legislation and House Finance right now. Should be done down here when that is done. Please turn off your cell phones or turn them to silent if you have them. Thank you, Maddie, and thank you, Martha, for helping facilitate today's meeting. We have a number of constitutional amendments on today's agenda. Before we get there, there'll be a presentation on building divestment with the Division of Facility Services, and we have a presentation as well. And I should add that the presentation will be given by Mark Davis, who is in Anchorage, who is the Division Director of Division of Facility Services. And we'll take a quick at ease just to get synced up really quickly. Coming back on the record, we got our presentation. Mr. Davis up in Anchorage, can you hear us?
This is Mark Davis. Yes, we can.
Great. Thank you. Please put yourself on the record stating your affiliation, and please proceed with the presentation, and our committee aide here in the room can move forward slides, so please note when you want to move forward a slide in the slide deck.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mark Davis. I am the director for the Division of Facility Services in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Good afternoon, Chair Christ-Tompkins and representatives on the State Affairs Committee. If we can go to slide number two, please. Slide two shows the agenda for the presentation today. Next slide, please. The purpose for the presentation today is to provide information about the Property Disposal Directive. Next slide, please. So on slide four, the facts bearing on the problem include the 2,274 buildings the state owns and that the state has a significant deferred maintenance backlog. The governor issued a Property Disposal Directive in mid-February requesting information on facilities, potential estimated cost savings, and recommendations listed in priority. OMB has agreed to let the Division of Facility Services assist in gathering the information required by the governor's directive and to work with the Facilities Council to develop recommendations. Next slide, please. These are the key, I'm on slide number five, timeline. These are the key events over the past few months. We've met with the Facilities Council on three separate occasions, several informal meetings with members of OMB. Our next scheduled meeting with the Facilities Council is for this Friday.
Chair Tompkins. Question?
Yes, Representative Story.
Thank you. Who serves on the Facility Council?
Through the chair, thank you. Representative, the Facilities Council is a member of 15 people that are designated by the departments, and they routinely work with the Division of Facility Services. We hold meetings at least once a quarter and now more often working this issue.
Could you follow up?
Follow up.
Could you give me an idea of who those people are?
So for the Division of Military and Veterans Affairs, it's Robert Carr. Health and Social Service is Amy Burke and Keith Stevens. Corrections is Dan Eicher. Education is Lisa Golisic. Pete Bonin is our Division of Ops Manager. He represents our department.
And Mr. Davis, sorry to interrupt. Would it be possible perhaps to email the list of facility service membership to the committee?
Sure. I was just trying to get a perspective of who serves on the council.
I have a question along that line.
And maybe to that question, if I may, Mr. Davis, would you speak to the kinds of positions each of the members of the council have? Like, who are they within these agencies?
Through the chair, it varies. Some are the facilities managers for those departments. Others are heads of certain divisions or major sub-organizations in the departments. We've also got representation from the Office of Management and Budget. And then, for example, with one of the organizations, it's the chief of the lab for DEC. So it just depends on who the organization thinks is the best person to represent them.
Representative Story.
I see the timeline here, and I'm just wondering who will be doing the deciding at the end of all this work.
Through the chair, representative, the decisions will certainly come from the Office of Management and Budget. Our role in all of this will be just to facilitate analysis, collection and analysis of the data.
Thank you.
And Representative Story, I should note, and maybe when Mr. Davis is done, Amanda Holland from OMB is available. Representative Wold, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, since the university is such a large component of your inventory, who represents the university on your committee?
Through the chair, we do not have a representative from the university. We intend to reach out and see if they care to join us. But based on that other branch of government, we haven't had one to this point. We do have a representative from the court system, but again, we're going to reach out and try to get a member from at least one of the three university locations.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, your first slide says over 1.98 billion in maintenance, and 1.2 of that is the university. So that's a pretty good chunk. Of the 2,200 plus buildings, how many of those buildings are university buildings?
Through the chair, I can get that information for you, and I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Thank you.
And I'm going to put a couple of questions on the record for Ms. Holland, maybe when Mr. Davis finishes the presentation, but to Representative Wohl's question about the university question for when we finally are able to bring you up, whether OMB and the executive branch has the effectively power or authority to unilaterally divest university properties. I'd have the same question for the court system and sort of where separation of powers comes in. But please proceed, Mr. Davis.
So I'm moving on to slide number 6. The next two slides will show a high-level approach our work group is using to meet the intent of the Property Disposal Directive. Our current effort is asking the Facilities Council representative members to work with their department leadership to place facilities into one of these three categories. The consider category is those facilities the departments believe are logical choices for gathering information to determine if selling that facility will be beneficial to the state. Those in the do not consider category are those assets believed to be the least likely to sell. And then every other case is identified to be put in the future analysis category. Based on the number of facilities our departments have, this provides a method to prioritize the work. The departments are still working to complete the consider selection process. Once we have all of the consider facilities identified, then we will review them against a set of criteria and develop specific recommendations.
Mr. Davis, when you say we will review them against a set of specific criteria and make recommendations, is we DOT and PF or is we OMB?
Chairman, the we in this case is actually two different groups. We will ensure that the Facilities Council rep is representing and is linked in with the concerns and the interests of their department. But we saw this as a great opportunity to have the Facilities Council discuss the different aspects and the criteria as a group. One particular example would be if there's a facility that's not being utilized to 100% of its capacity and another department sees an opportunity to move into that unused capacity, that's a potential opportunity for one building that's no longer needed.
Mr. Davis, so I understand the short answer to the question. Does that mean the we is the Facilities Council within DOT and PF that makes those recommendations?
Chairman, the Facilities Council are the reps from all of the departments.
So who's making the recommendation what property should be divested and not?
So the recommendation would be from the Division of Facility Services, but we certainly would not come up with a recommendation that's counter to what a department desires. So we are simply using this forum to discuss the merits of how we would prioritize those facilities and then presenting that from one organization in a uniform manner to OMB.
So I'll summarize to confirm my understanding. Your division will make those recommendations, but you will make those recommendations in consultation with the relevant agency. Is that accurate?
Chairman, that is correct. And we would not make a recommendation that would be counter to a department's desire.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Please proceed.
Next slide, please. So I'm on the slide titled Building Consideration Briefing, slide number 7. As facilities are identified for the consider category, the work group members will develop a one-slide snapshot similar to what you see now, to aid in collaboration with our team and for the leaders to have a discussion about the disposition of the facility. These slides will be updated as more information becomes available. This set of products will ultimately be the deliverable to OMB in the June and July timeframe. In this case, you see the annex building, which is where I'm at right now, is one example of a building that would be in the consider category. We are still waiting for more information in order to make a recommendation on this particular building. So it is a process that takes time, and as more information becomes available, these recommendations could change. So this is our way to track these buildings that rise to the top of the consider category, and then they will be passed to OMB at some point for them to continue the process.
Question?
Representative Suri.
So in this example that you're giving us, and if you the concept, if you sell the annex and take advantage of lease space in Anchorage and you site a University of Alaska facility, so that means in one way we are paying ourselves or paying UAA the $625,000 a year. Is that correct?
Through the chair, the decision has not been made. It is office space that would meet our needs. But we're not sure at this point whether that's beneficial financially for the state. So that is office space that is being considered. There was other office buildings that were looked at, but they're no longer available. So we continue to evaluate alternatives as they present themselves and update these slides.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. So, Chairman, this concludes my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take any questions you have.
And one additional question I have, could you restate when you anticipate Division of Facility Services having made its recommendations?
Chairman, our goal is to meet the suspense, which is the end of June. We are still gathering information on the first step of our analysis of getting the departments to submit the buildings they would categorize in the consider category. So at this point, I would say that we are a little bit behind, but our goal is to get this done and to OMB by July at the latest.
Thank you. And Ms. Holland, would you be available to make any comments in addition to this presentation, as well as speak to the previously posed question?
Chair Tompkins?
Representative Story.
Yes. So at what point will the information come back to this committee?
That's a good question. Ms. Holland, perhaps you could take that.
For the record, my name is Amanda Holland. I am Management Director for the Office of Management and Budget. Through the Chair, Representative Story, the information, the preliminary report, will come to the Office of Management and Budget from the Division of Facility Services near the end of June. That's the target date. At that point, OMB will be looking at the results to see how many facilities are in the consider category and how many facilities are in the should not consider or the future analysis categories. That will help us have a more comprehensive view of all of the properties that we're looking at in the facilities. And so we anticipate that preliminary list from Division of Facility Services at the end of June. OMB would be then looking at that list, doing some additional compilation of information and review and analysis, and we anticipate having our list, which is it takes the Division of Facility Services recommendations and has an aggregated report. So any additional information we gather would go into that report. We would submit that to the Office of the Governor within 2 weeks after we receive the information from Division of Facility Services. So that'd be at latest mid-July.
Follow-up?
Representative Story.
I heard you say that would go to the Office of the Governor. At what point, I'm wondering, will the information come back to this committee?
Through the Chair, Representative Story, we can provide the preliminary list of buildings at the same time to the legislature that we submit it to the Office of the Governor.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to speak to the question about the university as well as the court system and sort of where those separation of powers exists?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, OMB does not have authority over the university system or the courts to determine what they will do with their deferred maintenance or with their facilities, but we can invite them into the facilities council, and if they want to participate, we can work with them to look for additional opportunities for the state as a whole to realize some cost savings.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know the delineation between the university and the state dot puff. It seems because of that mention on that first page of the university's deferred maintenance as being a large number, that was somehow included in this whole process. And when they heard there wasn't anyone from the university on the committee, I was a little surprised. So, unless they're just not participating, since you don't really have the maybe the jurisdiction anyways, because they're in a different category, which also makes sense. So if you took the university numbers out of here, I'm curious how many buildings and how much deferred maintenance we're really talking about. And I know, like, for example, at UAF, there's some dorms that are kind of old and maybe not needed, but I can't imagine selling a dorm in the middle of a university campus. It doesn't, put in an office building or something. It doesn't make sense. So obviously something like that wouldn't really be considered. Some of these buildings are so intrinsic, probably state buildings too, like in some shed at an airport. You're not going to just sell it to a hot dog stand or something, So I don't know. I don't know what they're looking for, just to make some cash by selling real estate, which I think the university is trying to do anyways. But I'd be curious to see what kind of list and what kind of numbers they come up with.
Is that a question?
I can make it into one.
Well, maybe just to confirm, the executive branch has no authority to unilaterally divest university properties. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That is my understanding.
Okay, here's a question. In Fairbanks, for example, I know there's a big inventory of commercial real estate that's just sitting empty. We looked at moving our LIO at one point. We toured a bunch of buildings with a lot of square footage. They've been for sale for a long time. So adding buildings to the market for sale, and depends where they are, I suppose, doesn't necessarily mean anything as far as bringing in extra money. But I guess if you can move people around and lease space here and shutter buildings so you don't have to pay for, janitorial and stuff, that makes sense. So I guess, has that been considered, the fact that that putting for sale on some sign on something doesn't necessarily move it?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl. So the idea behind the Property Disposal Directive is to really take a look at all of our footprint, if you will, and say, are we really using that property in the most effective way possible? And if we're not, where might there be areas that we could do something that's more cost effective that could result in short and long-term cost savings potentially? Absolutely, part of the criteria in looking at those categories of what is in the consider bucket versus the do not consider the future analysis is going to look at what kind of deferred maintenance is in the building. Is there deferred maintenance associated with that property? What is the use of the property? What are the statutory requirements around that property? Is there any kind of market that would be interested in purchasing a building? Divestment of our property may not necessarily always be selling a building. There may be transfer of ownership to a local government, or there could be, we have buildings that if we can move people out of them, there's so much deferred maintenance that it actually results in a cost savings if we demolish the building and no longer have maintenance costs. So we're trying to look at every possibility out there.
Thank you. I follow up, and I'm glad to hear it. I thought you were already doing that. I think the university's been doing that for a while now, and I'm glad that you guys are doing it. If you weren't doing it before, I'm glad you're doing it now.
Representative Ledoux.
So was the university part of this program?
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the governor's directive focused on having each department look at its facilities, so those would be our operating agencies. That does not include the university.
Then I guess what I kind of don't understand, I mean, at the beginning of this PowerPoint presentation is, I mean, almost at the very beginning of the PowerPoint presentation, the second point is facts bearing on the problem. The state has a backlog of deferred maintenance valued at almost $2 billion. I mean, that's like a really big number. Mm-hmm. But then you look down at the little asterisk, and it looks like, $1.2 billion of that is the universities. So I kind of don't understand why this presentation is kind of, geared at the $2 billion mark when the university hasn't been, the administration and the university hasn't apparently been working in tandem about on this, so that I would think we'd be talking about the $0.8 billion unless we get the university involved in this process.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the backlog of deferred maintenance is one of the topics that are one of the focal points for us when we consider how we can use our property more effectively. And when we ask the question, how much are we using that property? Are there ways to consolidate functions? It is true that the entire backlog is $1.98 billion. We wanted to be clear that that $1.2 billion of that is the university. At OMB, we're really focusing on the operating agencies. Our report will go to the governor. I don't know at this point what activities the governor's office may be performing regarding the university. I can give you a breakdown of that leftover, if you will, backlog of deferred maintenance. So if you take the total $1.98 billion, we already discussed the university, $134.7 million is for school district major maintenance. $616.8 million is for executive agencies and the court system. If we look at the split in the executive agencies, $312.6 million of that $616 million is for facilities. And so while it doesn't address the entire backlog, it is a significant portion of the executive branch backlog. $6.3 million is courts. $219 million is highways. $58 million is aviation.
Ms. Halton, would you be able to provide those numbers to the committee?
Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Ledoux?
But you're not responsible for, I mean, the courts aren't part of this program either, right?
That's correct.
And I presume that the school districts aren't part of the program because they're not state-owned buildings, are they?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe this will clarify a little bit more the focus of this directive. The directive is designed to look at executive branch properties and to see, are there cost savings available there? Part of that directive could address some of the backlog of deferred maintenance. But the property disposal directive, it was not written for the purpose of completely solving the deferred maintenance backlog. So that's a contributing factor to consider when we look at what property we might dispose of. But they're related, but they're not reliant on each other. Does that help?
No, not really, because I just don't understand why you're talking about. It's almost like apples and oranges. I mean, why you're even talking about things that you have no control over, whether there's deferred maintenance or whether you can get rid of the building. So I was just asking you about the school districts. And so if the school districts have buildings, they, I think, belong to the school district. Or they're the municipality, unless they're, maybe if they're out in the REA, or whatever they are. I'm just a little bit confused as to why this isn't just focusing on the state-owned buildings in the areas that you can actually get rid of the buildings.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the directive does focus on executive branch state-owned buildings that we would have the ability to dispose of if that is determined to be the course of action. The information provided in the presentation was an attempt to identify the entire deferred maintenance backlog amount, simply so that we were acknowledging that that was one of the issues that we have to consider not the entire amount of the backlog, but the fact that there is some deferred maintenance backlog for the executive branch buildings.
I think perhaps a noble intention, but it seems perhaps to have created some confusion. Basically, you have no control over the courts, you have no control over the university, you have no control over school districts. So for the purpose of this committee, maybe we can just move that to the side and focus solely on executive branch agencies.
That would make me happy.
However.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, well, you're talking about making recommendations. So, I mean, you could just say to these other agencies or entities, look, we've looked at this and, you know, here's a recommendation. Take it or leave it.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Is the state responsible to pay for the deferred maintenance having to do with the courts and the schools? Is that why it's part of the discussion?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I will be the first to tell you that I am not an expert in the deferred maintenance fund or in deferred maintenance. We do have a deferred maintenance presentation that was given to House Finance Committee that I would be happy to share with this committee. I do know that there is a state backlog of deferred maintenance. I can give you the rough breakdown of where that split is, but I don't have the knowledge to be able to answer that question.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Representative Vance.
Just for clarification, just a statement, I think this is part of the directive that OMB is doing is earlier in the year, I had heard that some of the things that the administration was doing was looking at leases that the state had, and there was someone in the Department of Administration who spent one day looking at leases and realized that we were paying more than market prices and went to renegotiate and saved $17 million in one day just by renegotiating leases. So with that same mindset, I believe what I could see is that this was the directive to say, let's look at what else we're doing that we could be doing better. Is that kind of the same direction?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
What is the public process associated with this going to be? So maybe put more specifically, Division of Facility Services is going to make a suite of recommendations. It's going to go to the governor's office. The governor's office is going to make final calls. Say if facilities like the SJ Museum are put up for sale, I can tell you some people have some pretty strong feelings about that. When does the public get a say?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of a requirement for public comment or public process. I can certainly pass this on to the Office of the Governor as a recommendation from the committee.
Is there, to ratchet the question down a little bit, is there any plan at present for a public process?
Mr. Chair, at this time, I am not aware of what actions will occur once OMB submits its report to the Office of the Governor.
Okay. Consider it a recommendation for me as a recommendation in the Governor's office that there be some opportunity for people to have a say. I think also in line with Representative Story's question, would it be possible for the Division of Facility Services and or OMB to provide a list of the initial recommendations to this committee once that is complete?
Mr. Chair, yes, we can do that.
Thank you. And lastly, on Sheldon Jackson Museum, which has been a bit of a cause celeb, I think, of this broader process, can you give us some insight sort of how Sheldon Jackson Museum sort of got on the list, got into the public discussion as a state facility that, and also the contents of this facility that might be divested?
Mr. Chair, I am not aware of how or why Sheldon Jackson Museum was mentioned specifically. The Division of Facility Services is continuing to do its analysis with the Facilities Council. There is no list that I am aware of at this time of any facility or property. We're waiting for that report before we move forward with a recommendation to the governor's office.
And put more specifically, you can confirm that at present there is no affirmative plan to divest Sheldon Jackson Museum from state ownership?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Didn't do roll call, did you?
What's that?
Did you do roll call today?
Yeah.
I missed it.
Yes, you did.
I saw Representative Fields. I was like, wait a minute.
And I guess one last question for me. Are you the point person at OMB for this process going forward for the executive branch?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I am the point. I'm who the Division of Facility Services will provide that report to, and then I will work with other folks inside OMB, including the admin service directors, if we need any additional information before we send a report to the Office of the Governor.
Thank you very much for the information today. Mm-hmm. And seeing no further questions, I think that concludes the presentation.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Davis, as well up in Anchorage for being online.
Thank you, Chairman.
And also let the record reflect Representatives Wohl and Fields have joined the committee in the last 45 minutes, sometime within that span of time. At this point, we have four HJRs noticed, and I want to do a little bit of housekeeping first. The three from the governor, HJR 5, 6, and 7, we've sort of, in bite-sized chunks, worked our way through presentations. We had a presentation fairly thorough on HJR 6, I think two, maybe three committee hearings ago. We were able to get in some depth through HJR 5, the constitutional amendment on taxes and initiatives. HJR 7 kind of happened in warp speed last hearing, and it's my intention to circle back to that constitutional amendment and take a bit more measured opportunity to review HJR 7 today and hear from the administration on HJR 7. So all three were noticed today, and because they're all the governor's constitutional amendments, we're sort of noticing them as a bundle, but today wanted to start off with HJR 7. We also have HJR 18, which is this is the third hearing for HJR 18, and we sort of discussed that at some length yesterday. And at this point, I want to take committee action on HJR 18, and before doing that, offer the chance for committee comment if anybody does have comment. Representative Fields.
I want to thank the chairman for his work on this resolution and intend to support it because I think it's a fiscally conservative approach to ensure that we protect the corpus of the permanent fund and protect the permanent fund dividend. You know, I think in terms of the lifespan of my daughter, who's almost 18 months old, and I just like the idea that the permanent fund will be there as long as she has if we move forward with this structure. So I will be supporting the resolution.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Representative Ledoux?
I won't be supporting the resolution. I see this as a kind of the nose of the camel under the tent and kind of a way that we're going to end up with smaller PFDs.
Any further comment? Representative Wohl? Get on the bandwagon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had a lot of reservations about this resolution, and although my name is on there as a co-sponsor, I still have a lot of second thoughts about it. However, watching the Senate yesterday pass what I call the 3K Delta, the $3,000 permanent fund, which is now we have an unbalanced fiscal plan coming out of them, which we're going to have to draw. If that plan is to be exercised, we'll have to draw the money out of earnings reserve or CBR if there is enough. There probably is enough this year. So I think something like this is probably needed, some kind of long-term program so that Zach's daughter and mine are in a safe place financially as the state of Alaska goes. So I'll support this getting out of committee.
Thank you. Representative Fields, a motion?
I move House Joint Resolution 1831-LS0308-N with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Checked. Martha, would you please call the roll?
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Representative Story?
Yes.
Representative Wolf?
Yes.
Representative Vance?
No.
Representative Shaw?
No.
Representative Fields?
Yes.
Representative Price-Tompkins?
Yes.
Four yay, three nay.
And the motion carries, and HJR 18 moves from committee to its next committee of referral. That takes us to the next item on the agenda, HJR 7, and the administration is here to present. And as they're coming up, I want to make one other housekeeping note for any of the public listening online. We got through some public testimony, and we can take an at ease as needed. There was some public testimony that we got through previously. There will be another opportunity for more public testimony, and I think we will sort of set that up in a way that we can start and go as long as needed until we complete. So for anybody listening, want to put that on the record that there's a firm commitment to complete that public process. All good on the slideshow? All right. Welcome back to committee, and please put yourself on record, and I would say sort of pick up wherever you think would be most appropriate given the nature of the last hearing.
Corey Mills, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law, for the record, and I think what we'll do, because we kind of had to warp speed, as you said, through the presentation, we might go through it and just see where people have questions, but we won't necessarily go into detail. And then I might spend a little more time going through the sectional just to make sure everyone's on the same page.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed King, Chief Economist, State of Alaska. And I think Ms. Mills has a good idea here. We'll just flip across the slides if that's okay with you and take questions as they come up. So just moving to slide 2, this is a discussion on the current constitutional spending limit. I think Corey can talk a little bit more about that, if she likes.
Yeah, so Corey Mills again for the record. Again, the current constitution has an appropriation limit in it, and it set the baseline of that appropriation limit at $2.5 billion, and then every year you add inflation and population. And so the current calculation would be about $10.5 billion. There's a few other things in here about what it excludes, similar to our amendment, as well as an exception for capital projects. I think those are the things to highlight.
Question.
Representative Fields.
Could we see a slide of inflation-adjusted per capita spending for Alaska? I'm assuming that's in the slide deck.
Representative Fields, Mr. Co-Chair, we do have that slide, but it is not in this slide deck, so I can provide it to the committee.
Follow-up, perhaps in lieu of that, you could just confirm that per capita inflation-adjusted spending is as low today as it was in the, I believe it was late 70s, early 80s. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, that is technically correct, but maybe misleading. The years following that were actually lower, even though it is currently as low as it was at that time today.
Follow-up.
Representative Fields.
put differently, is it accurate to say that on a per capita inflation-adjusted basis, so we're looking at apples to apples, state spending is now lower than it has been at most points for the last 35 years?
Mr. Co-Chair, the current spending adjusted for inflation and population is higher now than it was in the late 90s and early 2000s.
On a per capita basis, correct. Deducting for PFD payments?
Mr. Co-Chair, the PFD payments are not historically considered part of the budget and therefore are excluded, so I would have to, okay. I would have to rethink that question a little bit before I could answer that completely.
Well, I guess just to close, Mr. Co-Chair, you know, the fact is that today we spend less money on a per capita inflation-adjusted basis in terms of operations of the government than at most points if not all, since the late 70s, early 80s. And I think it just shows that actually when you look at a cap, the cap has not been crossed because actually we have fiscal discipline. So I would just question the very need for such a cap, given that while certainly I don't think anyone could argue that there was fiscal discipline during the high oil price years, 2008 to 2013, since then we've engaged in very large budget reductions, and when you look at where we are with respect to spending, we're in a very fiscally constrained place.
All noted, and I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to dive further into those numbers and sort of understanding the need or argued need for this.
And if I know that the governor has presented some information that is not inflation adjusted and not adjusted on a per capita basis, and that's just very misleading to the public when the governor claims that spending has blown up when in fact it hasn't, and it's misleading not to take into account inflation, which has a very real impact on perceived government spending. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fields. And I think going forward, let's maybe get through the presentation and restrict to questions, and then I think there's robust potential for I know I'm not necessarily aligned with everything that is going to be presented, and I'm sure we can get to that. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, this might be the right time for this slide. This is the history of the state since 1975, adjusted for inflation for all of the different types of spending that the state engages in. So on the blue, that represents the agency operations adjusted for inflation. The orangish color represents mostly debt service payments, but what we call statewide items, also adjusted for inflation. And then the gray area of that chart represents the capital budgets, also adjusted for inflation. And so what you can see here is that during the period of 2005 to 2013, government spending increased significantly in response to an increase in revenue. And exceeded the level of spending that the government was engaged in the early 1980s when the oil revenues were really starting to flow, which created the need for the constitutional amendment back at that time in 1982. The dotted black line represents that spending limit, also adjusted for inflation, and that green line represents revenues. And you can see that correlation between revenues and spending. And it is true that the correlation is more tied to capital spending than it is to agency operations, but you can definitely see that that blue area did get bigger during that period of high revenues, and it has got smaller since then, but is still greater than what it was during that period of the early 2000s.
I have a question on this slide. It notes it's inflation adjusted. Is it also adjusted for population?
Mr. Chairman, this is not adjusted for population, just for inflation. And we've had that conversation. I don't remember if we had that conversation in this committee or not, but the question of whether a population adjustment is necessary is one that should be debated. And we know that there's what we call economies of scale. So when you have an increase in population, there is some need for increases in government services. For example, you have more cars on the road, you're going to need more roads. You have more kids in school, you're going to need more teachers. But what is the case is that it's not directly proportional. A 50% increase in population doesn't mean you need 50% more roads and 50% more schools and 50% more troopers. There is an increased need for spending for government services, but it's not that full proportional amount. And so when you make those population adjustments and you give credit for the full rate of a population, what you see is that the ability for the government to spend exceeds its need to spend. And you saw that from 1985 or so through about 2005, that 20-year period where the spending limit allowed that growth to occur, but the population did grow, almost doubled during that time, but the government spending did not. Not because it wasn't allowed to, but because for whatever reasons, the government at the time didn't feel it necessary to grow that government in response to that population growth.
And all of that noted that there's an arguable economy of scale and not having a one-for-one sort of discount for population growth, but this graph, for instance, gives no accounting for population growth. And what is the rationale for giving zero acknowledgement or recognition for population growth?
Mr. Chairman, when we talk about spending, just as economists, we usually talk about the purchasing power of a dollar. And what we usually talk about is what the inflation-adjusted value of that dollars are. So what this is trying to show you is if you had that same level of government services, what it would have costed in today's dollars. It's not suggesting what the right level of government service is. It's just simply telling you what the amount of money in today's dollars the government did spend. So to put population in here would be mixing apples and oranges a little bit. It's definitely something that we can do, and it does provide some insight and value, but it's not necessarily instructive on what government spending should be or necessarily what it was. But I do have a chart that I will be happy to provide to the committee on per capita spending, and you see a similar trend.
Okay. Before I go to Representative Wall, I'll speak for myself. You said it. Population growth may not be instructive to what the right level of government spending is, and I mean, I think I could run with this sort of ideological argument that there is a certain economy of scale as population grows, but I sort of categorically reject, if we're talking about what the appropriate level of government spending is, that population growth has no role and that we should just take this sort of pure academic economic outlook that it's just inflation adjusted dollars and we can forget about the people who actually live in the state and what they need. So I'll just request right here that we see that graph maybe in a future presentation that has the graph that you just mentioned. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It says here the current spending limit did not work. Can you talk to that about what's working or not working? The spending didn't exceed the limit. The spending didn't exceed the revenue, except for maybe a teeny bit in FY13, which is we can't say we're doing that anymore. But I mean, in the square that it says it doesn't work. Yeah, the revenue dips and the spending stays up. But as far as the spending limit, what didn't work?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, the idea behind the spending limit in 1982 was that when oil started to flow and the revenues more than tripled, that the government spending also increased by a substantial amount, and that created a situation where the public went to the polls and decided on a constitutional amendment to restrict the government from being able to grow at that rate. And the intent there was that limit would be effective so that in the future, if you had an increase like that again, that it wouldn't allow that same type of growth to occur. And what we saw was that because we had that 20-year period where where spending was far below the limit, but the limit continued to grow, by the time that we did find that excess revenues, the limit wasn't restricting the ability to spend. And so we saw in the early 1980s, we saw a 260-something% increase in government spending. In 2004 to 2013, you saw a very similar 260-something% increase in government spending. So if you accept the premise that the spending limit was put in place in order to limit government spending, then it did not work.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And this slide, Mr. Chairman, we just showed here, if there was a spending limit in place that was effective and did restrict the government from growing during that period, then it would have amounted to about $29 billion of additional revenues sitting in the permanent fund today, which would now be spinning off about $6 billion a year in the POMV under its current calculation. And therefore, the entire budget and still money left over for the permanent fund would be more than adequate had those funds not been spent in the past. Moving to the next slide, I know a lot of the time when we talk about government and government spending increasing over that period between 2005, especially through that period of 2013, there's a lot of questions over what exactly did increase and where that extra government spending occurred. So I provided this chart just to show. In 2013 specifically, you can see that the capital spending was $1.8 billion above what it was in 2005, adjusted for inflation, and agency operations themselves was $1.3 billion above what inflation-adjusted agency operations would have been. And then you do have some of the other categories that are more difficult to control. So in that time period, there was the ACES credits that the legislature allowed the purchase of those credits. In that year in particular, those credits, $400 million of those credits were purchased. And in addition, the change to the retirement system and the realization that there was an unfunded liability created a need for $614 million in that particular year. So you have this combination of different factors that led to this increase in government spending. A vast majority of it, about half of it, almost half of it, was in capital. But significant amounts of growth happened within the agency operations as well. Fast forwarding to 2019, the budget that was passed last year, you see that comparing the budget that was passed last year to the 2005 budget adjusted for inflation, agency operations are still $750 million above what they would have been if just adjusted for inflation.
Question?
Representative Story.
So when the state made the PERS and TERS investment basically in the retirement systems, wasn't that like $3 billion investment?
Representative Story, through the chair, yes, there was a $3 billion transfer. I believe it was in fiscal year 14. It was a transfer, so it's not indicated on this graphic. There was a $3 billion transfer. Actually, it was in 2015. That is why there wasn't a contribution in that year. And you can see that the blue bar gets smaller after that. That's because you're effectively prepaying down that liability. And so the years after that, that liability was reduced.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see consistently on your graphs comparing to, well, you at least refer to 2005 and on this current graph. Why the comparison with that time frame?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I'll just flip back two slides. And you can see that in the history, adjusted for inflation, in the history of the state spending, 2005 is kind of that low water mark, where government was as low as it has ever been in inflation-adjusted dollars. And so it doesn't seem like an unreasonable comparison that we would be able to get back to that level. It might be unreasonable to assert that we can get below that level, but it's certainly not unreasonable to conclude that we can get back to a level that we had already been at before.
Thank you.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this will bring back the population component, although it's not a direct one-to-one. You get agencies like HASS or the court system. You get a bunch more people in the state that are using these services. There's more people, you know, foster children, and all these numbers are going up. So you need more people to handle that increased workload. So I don't know that it's, as you say, one-to-one. It's probably not. But there is a population component, which you acknowledge, and I don't know how you scale that in. But I'm sure there's a way in the economics world.
Yes, Representative Wohl, through the chair, I'd be happy to do everything on a per capita basis and show those numbers as well. It is, like I said, it is informative. It's not necessarily instructive on what you should be spending as government, but it does kind of show how your level on a per capita basis has been changing. Again, that doesn't mean that, you know, as the population is growing, it doesn't mean that you need to increase government spending by the $17,000 per person for every new person that comes in. So I'm again saying it's not instructive on what you should do, but it may be informative. I'd be happy to provide that information.
I think the difference between instructive and informative is going to be a pretty profound distinction in this committee going forward. So I'm sure we'll revisit this, but I mean, considering that this constitutional amendment would directly limit the power of appropriation of this branch of government, I think you'll find, at least with me, that it's entirely instructive. I mean, it's our decision what's instructive and what's informative.
Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely, it's really a matter of opinion at the end of the day, and it's a policy call for you all to make. I would point out that education funding, for example, increased by something like 19 or 20% over that period, while the population of students increased by 0% over that period. So again, it's a question of not just does another person move to the state, but also what services do they require? And so it's not an easy question to answer, and I appreciate the difficulty.
Representative Ledoux.
So do you actually need this amendment if the budget is passed by the Senate, where they stuck, I think, $12 billion into the corpus of the permanent fund? If that remains, wouldn't that kind of solve any spending problem in that there'd be no money or very little money?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, the the removal of that safety net, if you will, does take away one of the tools for dealing with increasing government spending. But, however, it doesn't prevent the government from growing through taxation or from using PFDs or from doing some other form of if revenues were to increase again in the future, it doesn't prevent that growth to occur. So although that does help put downward pressure on the budget, it doesn't actually solve the issue that we're trying to address.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
I just want to make sure it's clear. My reading of this is appropriations for a fiscal year would not exceed the average of the appropriations for the last three fiscal years plus 50% of inflation and population or 2%, whichever is less. So that would lock us into perpetually fewer dollars per person in terms of appropriations. Is that correct?
Representative Fields through the chair, yes. Under the current structure that it's provided to you there, the government spending would not be able to grow at the rate of inflation and population. That is correct.
I think one absurd outcome of that is we have an aging population that, for better or worse, costs more. Some percentage of that is state. And the notion that we would arbitrarily reduce every single year expenditures, notwithstanding our population or needs or anything else, is just crazy.
Oh, Representative Ledoux.
Does any other state have a constitutional appropriations cap?
Representative Ledoux through the chair, I'm sorry, we don't have that information available right now, but we'll get it back for you.
Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said something I just got to ask again. You said the school population didn't go up between when and when?
Representative Wall through the chair, the school population has been relatively steady since about 1990 at about 130,000 students.
Follow up?
Representative Wall.
Even though the state population's gone up a few hundred thousand?
Yes, that's correct.
What about follow up? What about prison population?
Representative Wolfe, I don't have that answer.
At least something's growing.
Yes. Representative Wolfe, through the chair, absolutely. The demographics show that what is growing is the aging population.
Right.
Yes.
Please proceed.
So Corey Mills again for the record, and we'll kind of skip this slide and I think go to the next one to just walk through the sectional. I think some of these decision points have already been highlighted. And starting at section 1A of the resolution before you, you know, the big points of decision are really what are you setting your baseline at? In the current constitutional limit, it's 2.5. And then what's your growth rate? In the current constitution, that growth rate is population and inflation, and as you saw, that didn't keep any sort of reasonable basis with what actually occurred in terms of spending. And then so in the resolution before you, the baseline is changed from 2.5 to the average of the last 3 years appropriations, as Rep. Fields mentioned, and then it goes up by a 50% of the change in population and inflation over the course of that year. Or 2%. It's capped at 2%, and I think Mr. King could tell you, you know, that we're probably not, I think he says that we're not going to reach that 2% under current estimates. But you are capped at 2%. And then the next kind of decision point after that comes in A1 through 8, which is really what are your exceptions? So what do you want to count inside the cap under your appropriation limit, and what do you want to count outside the cap? In other words, you don't have a ceiling on those particular spending items. And so this gives you kind of just a graphical representation of what falls under the cap, which is everything under the red line and the blue bars. And then the orange is what falls outside the cap. And the main things you think of are your federal funding receipts, Your PFD is outside the cap, and most of these are what exists in the current Constitution as exceptions. We laid them out in a little more delineated fashion, but it's basically the same except for capital spending.
Representative Fields.
Could you explain capital subject to capital not subject? What's what? What's in the cap? What's out of the cap?
Yeah, so if you, and I guess for that we can kind of go through the exceptions. Exception one is relates to the permanent fund. Exception two is disasters. Exception three is obligations for bonds. Four is just your reappropriations that you do. Five is duplications. Six is money held in trust by the state or received from the federal government for a particular purpose. So that's your federal monies. And the GO bonds, sorry, going back to three, Rep Fields, to your question, capital outside the cap is your GO bonding that you get through general obligation bonds and the payment on that debt. The capital within the cap is your normal capital budget items that you appropriate on an annual basis. Because currently, under this version, the Senate made some changes, but under this version, all capital except for GO bonds are within the appropriation limit.
Thanks for that explanation. I guess I would just note in states that have put arbitrary appropriations limits on themselves, one way that they've gotten around it is through bonding, which under certain fiscal environments might make a lot of sense if interest rates are very low, but under others merely adds to the cost of doing infrastructure and is one of the absurd outcomes of these sort of arbitrary appropriations caps.
And Rep Fields, through the chair, that is exactly a policy call. You know, the administration determined that having to do geo bonding and going to a vote of the people and have the people involved in that decision was the right way to go about large infrastructure projects. Others disagree on what you should do on bonding. The Senate included an exception for 10% up to the cap. So it's definitely a decision point, and we've heard a lot of discussion about that.
Can you speak a little bit more to DGF subject to cap and sort of types of DGF that would be, just to sort of illustrate what that would mean?
Okay. So designated DGF, of course, is designated general funds. And you think of these as your program receipts for the most part when you get fees and licenses. And for the most part, all of those are going to fall under the cap. They are not distinguished by this appropriation limit. They're not distinguished by the current constitutional appropriation limit. They're all just considered appropriations. When you look at your designated general funds not subject to the cap, you can think of like paying on revenue bonds through revenues that your corporations get. Are there other examples? And university tuition receipts, some of those items. But most of your designated general funds that you think of, licenses, fees, that go, you know, are softly designated for a specific purpose but have to be appropriated every year, would still fall under the cap.
And what's the policy thinking for including DGF within the cap?
Mr. Chairman, it's mostly just a matter of effectiveness. We didn't, or the administration doesn't want the ability for you to, for the legislature to circumvent the cap simply by designating some funds. So the one example might be like vehicle rental tax, for example. You can collect that tax, you can put that tax in a special account, and you call it designated, and you can only use it for parks or tourism. What would stop the legislature from doing that same thing with other types of taxes and fees?
Corey Mills again, for the record. I would also say that we have to remember we're dealing with the Constitution in this case. And designated, you know, general fund is only mentioned once in the Constitution. It was added by the Budget Reserve Fund, any sort of reference. So designated general fund versus unrestricted general fund is just not a term we have used in the Constitution. And so how do you talk about revenues in a way that doesn't use these kind of accounting terms we've selected, but how do we do it in a constitutional context is also a struggle.
Representative Ledoux.
So I want to go back to the bonds for a second. So a geo bond, what does geo bond stand for?
Sorry, general obligation bonds.
Okay, and so do all general obligation bonds have to be approved by the people?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes. That is a separate constitutional provision in Article 9. I believe it's Section 8. And you can't, no state debt shall be contracted unless authorized by law for capital improvements. So they're only for a specific type for capital improvements. And there's a few other exceptions to that. And they all have to go to the voters. They have to be ratified by a majority of the voters.
And how about How about revenue bonds?
So through the chair, Rep. Ledoux, that is a separate constitutional provision that allows for revenue bonds. Those do not have to go through the people. They just have to have the revenue to support them.
So
Representative Ledoux.
Okay. So give me an example of a revenue bond. Do we use revenue bonds here?
Through the chair, Rep. Ledoux, yes, the state does, and it specifically says in the Constitution it's a public enterprise or public corporation, and that's where you see them most often. A good example that people would know, AHFC mortgage bonds, that's a good example. ADA also does a number of revenue bonds, and the specific requirement is that the debt incurred through the issuance of revenue bonds when the only security is the revenues that the corporation will receive. So you have to have sufficient revenue stream to pay them off.
Representative Ledoux?
So I guess I'm just thinking, I'm kind of thinking out loud here. I mean, is the exception of a revenue bond, which doesn't need the vote of a people, a loophole that you could kind of drive a truck through? Meaning, could the legislature initiate a tax, for example, and then while before the tax money comes in, support that through a revenue bond?
This is like we're trying to game the constitutional spending limit before it's even been enacted. This is great.
Through the chair, Rep. Ledoux, I'm just trying to think exactly how that would work. It does have to be revenues that the public corp is receiving in general taxes. You can't surrender the taxation power. The legislature can't surrender their taxation power. So I don't know if you could have a public corp doing a tax. But your point is still taken that there are ways to do revenue bonds if you have a specific item or program that is going to generate some sort of receipts and can pay off those bonds, that those are opportunities that could be used and may be used more, if you come up under a stricter cap.
So I guess kind of my point is that if we're putting out this constitutional amendment and the policy decision is because you don't trust the legislature to be able to keep its hands off money, then you have to kind of assume that the same legislature that you don't trust to keep its hands off money is going to do whatever is possible in order to finance things that might be excluded by the cap. And so that's just kind of why I was asking the question.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, for the record, Ed King again. I would just note that in the case of these revenue bonds and public corporations, that the corporation has to have the authority to provide a service and then generate revenues in the provision of that service. And so the difference being that you can't just, or the legislature could just levy a tax and then spend that money for government purposes however it like. In this situation, you have to, the revenues have to support the bond. And so you can't just quote unquote force the public into the revenues. You have to sell a product that they're willing to pay for. And so it has to be self-sustaining. If the government is subsidizing that public corporation, that subsidy is within the cap. It's only to the extent that the corporation can support itself and those revenue bonds through its own generation of revenues that would be excluded.
Representative Fields.
Well, this is a great point from my colleague. We were just talking about the Pioneer Homes, and under this model, we could have a Pioneer Homes corporation. They could have revenue bonds to recover 50% of the cost, and we could subsidize the rest. So only 50% of the cost would be in the cap. But I did want to mention, you know, all these states that have arbitrary caps really just end up with convoluted ways of taxing. And one that was really interesting to me was metro districts in Colorado. Colorado is an example the administration's used. Colorado is very different because actually local government is much more significant in terms of providing public services. So what happened in Colorado in response to the Taxpayer Bill of Rights is local metro districts got established to tax outside the cap. And as of this article in the Hill that I'm reading, there were 1,633 metro districts for a combined debt of $19 billion in the state of Colorado. And in some districts, it's not like you have just one metro district for Denver. You could have one metro district that taps out its money, then you establish another one to tax to that cap, then you establish another one to tax to that cap in the same jurisdiction. So you end up spending the same amount of money, but in a very convoluted way. And I think your point about revenue bonds really gets at that underlying reality. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that if you, when you make those kinds of evaluations, you should also evaluate the counterfactual and understand what would happen without that limit in place and then compare those two outcomes. And I believe that in all of the states that do have an appropriations limit that is effective or a spending limit, their spending has been more restricted than those states that don't. And even if you do find ways to circumvent the rules, it does still have some effect on limiting that spending.
I have, I guess to Representative Fields' example, how closely has the administration analyzed Colorado's TABOR? And I guess as Mr. Barnhill comes up earlier, am I remembering correctly that Representative Vance or Ledoux asked what other states had enacted a, and I thought I heard Mr. King just mention if you look at other states that had enacted a constitutional spending limit. So okay. So if you're familiar with it, I would be grateful if you could answer the previously stated question.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, OMB Policy Director, and to Representative Ledoux's question from a few moments ago, it turned out I did have the list in my folder. It just took me a few minutes to dig it out. So the National Conference of State Legislatures has a nice webpage on states with appropriation limits. They come in two flavors, statutory and constitutional. As of the date of this list, which is somewhat dated, it's 2010 there, 23 states that have either a constitutional or a statutory appropriation limit. And those limits are also come in a variety of forms. Some states use adjusted gross income, a percentage of adjusted aggregate adjusted gross income within the state as the limit. So say 8% or 10% of the adjusted gross income of individuals, and that represents states that use the income tax as a primary form of revenue. Some states have, like Alaska, a base that's adjusted through inflation. In terms of the Colorado experience, there's a fair amount of discussion over the efficacy of Colorado, and as Mr. King said, you can look at all of these analyses in a variety of ways. The folks that support TABOR, which is inclusive of requiring a vote of the people to impose a new tax as well as an appropriation limit, point to the economic growth in Colorado since 1992. And it is absolutely a fact that Colorado has grown enormously since they enacted their TABOR. But is that because of TABOR or in spite of TABOR? We don't know. We just know that the economy has grown considerably. With respect to Alaska, I think the problem that we're trying to address here, it would be nice to have economic growth as a result of amending the Constitution. But the real problem is that our budgeting is volatile because our revenue source is volatile. We have these huge upticks in the price of oil. Our budget chases those huge upticks in the price of oil. When oil resets back down, as it's done in 2015, it's very difficult, it's very disruptive to reset our budgeting when the price of oil declines precipitously. And so fundamentally what the administration is proposing in this set of constitutional amendments is to smooth out that volatility by smoothing out spending. Because obviously the state has been in budgeting turmoil for several years, and this year is no different.
Mr. Barnhill, before you continue, and I've got Representative Fields in the queue, I might have missed this in the initial presentation, but in talking about the budget chasing upticks in oil, which is a statement I can recognize and identify with and sympathize with, I want to understand the current constitutional spending cap in FY08, and I think this is slide number 3 in your deck. You've got never mind. My question is moot. Representative Fields.
Well, since we're on the subject of Colorado, I did, for people who are listening, just want to cite some statistics of the outcomes of an appropriations cap in Colorado. Between enactment of the cap in 92 and 2006, Colorado declined from 35th to 48th in K-12 spending as a percentage of personal income. Colorado's average teacher salary declined from 30th to 49th in the country. Higher education per resident dropped 31%. Tuition increased 21%. Colorado declined from 23rd to 48th in the nation in the percentage of pregnant women receiving adequate access to prenatal care. And Colorado plummeted from 24th to 50th in the nation in the share of children receiving their full vaccines. And vaccine funding got low at some points. That the state suspended its requirements that school children be vaccinated against diphtheria, tetanus, and whooping cough because Colorado could not afford to buy vaccines. I mean, that is precisely the kind of absurd set of outcomes that we should seek to avoid. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't want to get into extensive arguments about what's happening in Colorado or not happening, but I've heard two suggestions about what's going on in Colorado. One is that the spending cap is working, and it's producing really difficult outcomes. And then 5 minutes later or before, we're talking about how it doesn't work at all. And so it seems to me you can't have it both ways. Either it's working or it's not working.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. Actually, I think clearly what's happened is an inability to provide adequate revenue has produced these outcomes. And at the same time, at the local level, governments have scrambled to adjust to very real needs. And scrambling to adjust results in these highly inefficient and absurd structures like multiple metro districts taxing within a region. Actually, you can have both occurring at the same time, inadequate support for core infrastructure investment, along with government scrambling to do the best it can under impossible circumstances.
And fair enough. I guess what we're hunting for here is a way in the Alaska context to create control over spending so that we eliminate or at least reduce the volatility in our budget making process. I think it's inarguable that our budget, as shown in these charts, has chased the price of oil. And fundamentally, we just need to find a way to get away from that.
Of the other states with a constitutional spending limit, which is the most the closest analog to what is being proposed here?
In terms of a base that's adjusted by inflation and population, I believe there's a number of states that have a base that's adjusted by inflation and population.
And noting that, that's sort of a genus, if you will, of a constitutional spending cap. I mean, what is the species? Because what you include in the base, what you don't include, there's a lot of details that are fairly relevant. I assume or hope that that degree of sort of comparative research happen? And is there a specific state or specific constitutional spending cap that's the closest analog to what's being proposed?
Perhaps the best thing I can do, Mr. Chair, is just provide the table to the committee, and we can go through it at a later date. I don't have the answer to you today. What we're trying to do with respect to this particular constitutional amendment is it's updating what we already have. So we started with a $2.5 billion base that's adjusted by inflation and population. We're just amending that so that it will work.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this spending cap were enacted now, what would be our spend for this next year?
I'm just going to swap out Mr. King's opinions.
Representative Vance, to the chair. For the record, Ed King again. So again, remember that there is spending that occurs under the cap, and there is spending that occurs outside of the cap. So the spending that would be allowed to occur under the cap would be something like $5.4 billion, and that is all of your UGF and the DGF that is restricted for the most part. The actual proposal that's before the body now is below that limit, and that's just a function of the fact that your last 2 years that are part of that, the last 3 years that are generating that average, are higher because the budget has been being reduced over the last few years. So the passage of the spending limit doesn't force budget cuts to occur. That's the prerogative of the legislature. And in this particular instance, the limitation would likely be in excess of what the legislature would actually spend.
Follow up.
Representative Vance.
So it would just be a soft rise over the years, rather than we could, you know, just cause it to spike with the price of revenue, but it would slowly be the up to 2% each year based upon where we're at now.
Representative Vance, through the chair, that would be the upper limit. If the legislature elected to spend less than that, then the limit would adjust to that lower level of spending. So it wouldn't necessarily allow, or it would not require the cuts to occur, but if the legislature elects to make those cuts, then the limit follows it down. So it's always adjusting so that you don't get this kind of detachment like we have in the current limit.
Follow up.
Representative Vance.
I'd like to go back to the chart that talks about what's included in the cap and what's not. Can you speak to why the PFD is not included in the cap?
Yes, Representative Vance, through the chair. Generally speaking, you want to include anything under the cap that you want to limit to grow, to limit the growth of. So if you want to limit the growth of government and government spending, then you should include that, the agency operations under the cap. The governor does not want to limit the growth of the PFD. He thinks that the PFD is a off-budget item that is the people's money and should be given to them and should therefore not be subject to the cap.
This is Corey Mills again, for the record. I also just want to clarify, and I think I said this earlier, and Mr. Barnhill might have said it, but we really did follow what's in the existing Constitution. So when it comes to these exceptions, we relied in great part on what the people approved, both in 1982 and came back again in 1986 and reapproved. What we really adjusted was the baseline, and like we said, capital spending was the big decision point that the governor made. But when you're looking at how we compare to other states, we started from a baseline of we already had one. And so we looked at what do we have and how do we want to adjust that growth rate, at least in terms of drafting. That was the direction we were given, just to clarify.
Representative Ledoux.
So this list of states that have spending caps, Alaska is already included in that list. So I guess what I'd be interested in, and it might be the same thing that Representative Christ Tompkins was mentioning, the states that actually have tighter spending caps, because we know that the one that we have now is a fairly generous cap.
And I'll elaborate that as, I think, a sort of standing request. I mean, what I want is the state with the constitutional spending cap closest to what you're proposing? I understand that this is sort of iterating on the structure that already exists, because I think that, at least for me, presents an opportunity to talk with policymakers in that state and ask what's working well, what's not, how is it being gamed, if it's being gamed at all. So just to sort of understand the intent or the why behind the request, that, at least for me, that's why I'm curious.
So, and then one more question. So it almost seems to me that perhaps the reason, the thinking behind this is when oil prices are really low, like they are now, I mean, you kind of have to forcibly go on a diet. And it's sort of like binge eating or binge drinking or something like that. So then oil prices get high, and there's all this pent-up demand that people and municipalities and nonprofits and agencies, et cetera, you know, who've been forced on a diet for a while, then there's lots of money, and so then they're there asking for the money, and then you end up, you know, for a few years, everything is wonderful, and then oil prices go down again, and you're dealing with the pain of cutting things. Is that sort of the thinking that?
Representative Ledoux, yes, through the chair, yes. The spending limit would provide stability. The volatility of oil revenues creates this problem where the government spending follows those revenues trends, like as you're saying. And so by having a spending limit in place, you don't get that upswing in spending. Therefore, when they fall, you don't have to make all of those difficult cuts because you weren't allowed to make the increase in the first place. You also have stability because you can afford that level of spending. When the times are good, that money goes into the savings account. When the times go bad, you have that savings account to draw on. So this is very much a way that you can smooth out that volatility, and that way you don't have to make the kinds of tough decisions that we're trying to make today.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
I guess I just want to point out a degree of volatility, particularly with respect to capital spending, is not actually a bad thing. Number one, you might want to make countercyclical capital investments to reduce the negative impacts of unemployment. Number two, some capital investments, most actually, tend to last a long time. So we made capital investments in the 80s, and LUSAC Library is still with us. Sure, we have to maintain it. But the fact that we built these structures and that it costs more money 40 years ago is not actually a sign of poor discipline. It's a sign that we need to build a library at some point. So I think, you know, constraining ourselves that way is actually probably bad economic policy. I did want to ask, my office has been getting some calls from the Koch brothers organization, AFP. Was that of the direction or suggestion of the governor's office, or is AFP doing that independently?
I can't. I have no information on that issue.
Okay. Well, the people calling are very confused. So if it was of the direction of the governor's office, they might appreciate a little additional background about what HGR7 actually does.
And Mr. Chairman, there was a question before the comment, if I can address that. Representative or Mr. Co-Chair, the issue with the capital budget, there's nothing in the spending limit that would prevent countercyclical capital items to still occur. They would just need to happen through bonding. And through that bonding process, you actually end up also smoothing out the construction cycle because you have those fixed payments on those bonds, and you have the ability to issue those bonds when you need to. They don't have to happen, you know, they happen in response to need. So there's nothing in the spending limit that prevents capital from occurring.
Representative
Fields.
And I would support geo bonding right now. Given interest rates, I would just point out that geo bonding has a much longer time frame because it has to go to voter approval, and there are some environments in which geo bonding is financially prudent given interest rates, and there are other environments where you actually don't want to borrow money because of very high interest rates, and that flexibility is important.
And now that Representative Fields mentions it, actually, I mean, this is a bit germane to me. There is a robocall service that seems to be afoot, and it generates automatic voicemails to the email inboxes of members of this committee, including myself. And the domain is an alaska.gov domain from which those emails are being sent. So we're going to be hearing public testimony, but I've never seen this before from the executive branch, and I'd like to better understand what's going on, perhaps at the next hearing, exactly how the governor's office is sort of engaging on these constitutional amendments, or sort of where the money is coming from for this sort of you could call it astroturfing, or you could call it grassroots engagement, depending on your perspective, Representative Ledoux.
So I actually don't have any problems with legislatures, the governor, or who have you, you know, if they want support for something, to ask people to send in support. What I do have problems with is voicemails which say, you know, I'm your constituent, you know, and please vote for such and such. And I live in East Anchorage, and they say they're my constituent, and then they live in Songdatna or something. So it's usually more effective to actually channel those calls directly to the legislator that is actually the constituent of those people.
Yeah, and if I might follow up, I don't have an objection to the governor using a bully pulpit. I do have an objection to that function effectively being taken over by an outside dark money funded organization. That's why I asked the question about coordination with AFP.
Could we,
Representative Vance?
Could we please remember that they are representing the Department of Law and probably not the communications of the governor? Can I ask if we could finish the presentation?
I think that's a great suggestion, and but I think coming back would be interested to understand a little bit more, recognizing that none of you have the answers this time. And maybe as a segue, I think this was the slide that we were on, and perhaps knock out the last couple of slides.
Corey Mills again for the record, and we're happy to take those concerns and suggestions back. Moving on to section, this covers 1B and C of the resolution, and these would be new sections. And what they do is they create a savings waterfall. So the thought is, as we talked about, if you're cutting off the volatility and creating kind of more of a stable, sustainable level of government spending, that when we did have excess revenues, those would then go into savings. And what savings would those go into? So the resolution proposes to start by taking excess revenues and basically determining about how much was given for the PFD, or 50% of the income that the permanent fund created, and giving that back to the principal. So it's trying to continue to grow the permanent fund and repay it for what it's paying out to us. And so once you reach that 50%, then you move to priority number two, and that's to take the CBR, what this resolution would change to the savings reserve fund, and fill it up to the appropriation limit level. That thought is you have enough to pay for a whole year's spending in the savings reserve fund. And then if you have so many excess revenues that there's still more to go, then you'd put the rest into the permanent fund principal to, again, continue growing the permanent fund. So that's the savings waterfall, and that's kind of the end of section one of the resolution.
On that waterfall, I'm not sure I fully understand priority number one, paying back into the permanent fund principal 50% of the income that was deposited in the ERA. Could you describe that once more, or maybe describe it through example?
Yes. So I guess we can sort of have the example this year, and I'll just take $2 billion. So let's say the permanent fund spun off income in the last year in the amount of $4 billion. Then you would take, if you got excess revenues, you would do a calculation of what is 50% of the income that the permanent fund earned, and you say that's $2 billion, and you'd put the $2 billion into the principal. So it really, it's a calculation. It's not kind of a one-for-one. You're not moving money from the ERA necessarily into the permanent fund principal. In fact, what you're doing is saying we got excess revenues, like there was more oil money that came in this year. And so this really determines what the calculation is of the amount that goes back. And the thought was that you're just trying to kind of replace the income that was likely used, because the calculation for the PFD under current statute, permanent fund dividend, is 50% of statutory net income. You know, it's over 5 years, but this is kind of taking what you get in income in any given year. So that was the thought process.
Okay, so if I understand that correctly, if there was a constitutional spending limit as proposed by the administration in effect, and oil prices went really up, there's a lot of surplus UGF sloshing around, that extra revenue would, unless the market was really, really bad, and there was very, very little revenue being spun off the principal of the permanent fund into the earnings reserve of the principal fund, that extra UGF revenue would go into the principal of the permanent fund, up to $2 billion in the example that you gave. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. Correct. Okay. And then you'd have kind of this fall. You'd start there, and if for some reason you had so much extra revenue, you'd go to the next bucket, which is the savings reserve fund or the CBR as we know it now, and then the final one is just anything left over would go into the permanent fund.
So I'm taking that information, and in most years you have good markets. Occasionally you have bear markets. Occasionally you have negative growth or piecemeal growth coming out of the permanent fund. Under this constitutional spending limit, in effect, almost all surplus revenue is going to go back into the principal of the permanent fund, which in effect, over the medium and long term, will result in ever bigger dividends growing. If you average out markets over the medium and long term, dividends that are growing in excess of the rate that dividends have grown over the last nearly 40 years. Is that effectively an accurate takeaway?
Mr. Chairman, when I run the numbers, that is exactly what I find. Yes.
Could you, when you run the numbers, what would the size of the permanent fund, if we enacted this constitutional spending limit as proposed, what would the size of the dividend be under projected market conditions in 20 years from now?
Mr. Chairman, the question is challenging because there are so many moving pieces and assumptions. Under the baseline assumption, it would only grow with inflation. The principal would only grow with inflation because there is not a projected surplus in any of the next 20 years. So only because of volatility would you get these situations where you have occasional additional revenues that would be subject to this waterfall. And in the majority of those cases, there are insufficient funds to get past priority number one.
Okay, so what you're saying is in the model that you're running, this waterfall, water never actually spills through this waterfall in the model that you've run.
It's very rare, yes, Mr. Chairman. It's in those situations where oil prices are high and investment returns are low that you get a deposit into the CBR.
Okay, thank you. Other questions on this slide, Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you for spending a lot of time in my office on this. They were very generous because I always have so many questions. On this waterfall, I was wondering why the priority of putting back into the corpus before going to our savings. And the reason I think of that is with many surplus years, usually what follows is many lean years, and you know what we've seen now. And if we're only putting in on priority two, am I understanding 1 year's worth of appropriation that doesn't really set us up for multiple lean years to be able to draw from in our savings? Or am I missing something here?
Representative Vance, through the chair, during the process of the deliberative process of putting this together, there were policy decisions that were made. And I believe one of those policy decisions was this idea that since money is coming out of the permanent fund in order to pay the dividends, if there are excess revenues, those funds should be returned. And that was just a policy decision that was made. When I run the numbers, though, I do find that very often the CBR is insufficient to weather the volatility. And so I think the administration would be happy to discuss changes to that.
Follow-up?
Representative Vance.
Just from my understanding is with this constitutional amendment, any excess revenue would automatically go to the waterfall. So this is the only mechanism to set money aside into savings?
Representative Vance, through the chair, the prerogative of the legislature still prevails. If they choose to put money into savings, they certainly could. And transfers to savings accounts are excluded from the cap. So it is okay. Still your prerogative. But to the extent that there is additional funds in excess of the limit and the legislature didn't voluntarily do that, then it would follow this waterfall.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Just for clarification, we spend to the cap. We still have money left over. We could put money into the savings account, however much we wanted, and then if there was magically still more money left over, then it could start into the waterfall account.
Representative Vance, through the chair, that's my reading of the,
okay,
the language.
Thank you.
Yes.
Cory Mills again for the chair, and I just point to it's paragraph 8, so page 2, line 13, specifically talks about being outside the cap, money to a state savings account or fund that requires a subsequent appropriation.
Representative Ledoux, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. I just want to confirm this, that any amount we could put into the savings account before we put it into the corpus of the...
Through the chair, Rep. Ledoux, correct. That is one of the exceptions, and so that could be done before you determine what excess revenues exist.
Representative Fields.
Well, I see we're approaching the end of the hearing, and, you know, at a basic level, we're talking about balanced budgets, and I just wanted to reference what business leaders have recently told us. Southeast Conference recently polled business leaders, and these were the top solutions identified by business leaders. Reduce oil tax credits, reduce PFD payments, more POMV use, we just voted on that, income tax, and increased corporate taxes. Again, these are what business leaders told the legislature we should be doing to balance the budget. I also want to reference, because it's from my home community of Anchorage, a letter from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation that was addressed to the governor and the speaker and the Senate president. And AEDC said, we strongly support a balanced approach between targeted necessary cuts, new broad-based sources of revenue, and the permanent fund. The AEDC board believes this is the only way that the state and local economy will achieve the fiscal stability required for promoting new investment and expansion of existing businesses, and ask for your consideration. And, you know, I guess I would just note that this package that we're considering, these three HARs, are not balanced and don't meet what these business groups have asked of us, nor are they consistent with what we've heard from Alaskans who participated in the process of reaching out with the House Finance Committee.
Just for clarification, first of all, this doesn't prevent the legislature from still doing a POMV approach, taking money from the permanent fund, and that, in fact, that was my understanding of one of the policy goals, was to grow the permanent fund for the dividend, but also for government expenditures. And nothing about this talks about taxes and whether or not those are appropriate.
On that last comment, you said growing the permanent fund for dividends and for government expenditures. Can you unpack the for government expenditures part of that comment?
Yes, I think it was assumed when we were doing this that we had a statutory percent of market value draw from the permanent fund. And the way this works is any draw from the permanent fund would just go into the general fund and then fall under the cap in terms of spending outside of there, but it doesn't restrict any money coming out of the earnings reserve account.
Thank you. Next, last slide, I think.
Yeah. Very last slide. Hopefully not too much time on this, but this is how the resolution would propose to change the budget reserve fund. It would change the name, savings reserve fund. That's a decision, but the important parts are the meat. So you wouldn't change the payments that came in terms of filling up the budget reserve fund. Currently, you have tax and royalty settlements that go in. You'd still have the same tax and royalty settlements go in. And then you'd also have this portion of excess revenues if the waterfall actually got to that point, that would go in as well. So you'd have this added source. And then on our current budget reserve fund, as I believe you all know, we have a provision subsection D of the budget reserve fund. Calls for a sweep of funds in the general fund every year if you've taken money from the budget reserve fund and it hasn't been repaid. Until it's repaid, you're supposed to sweep general fund monies available at the end of the year into the budget reserve fund. As I think you also know, that has been reversed every year in which a repayment obligation is required by three-quarters vote, because under the budget reserve fund, you're able to access it by a three-quarters vote. And so that's how you reverse the sweep is, I think, the terminology that some use. It never goes in, it theoretically goes in, and then it goes right back out with a three-quarters vote back into the funds where the funds sat. So that's what we talk about with the sweep and the reverse sweep. And in the new savings reserve fund in this resolution, that whole portion gets eliminated. It would repeal the sweep into the general fund because we now have this new way of savings in the savings waterfall. It would also repeal the three-quarter vote allowance for any public purpose. And instead, it would allow you to access by majority vote the reserve fund, but it would only be to fill the gap. You would determine what's available for appropriation, so what revenues came in, what's in the general fund, and then you determine what the appropriation limit is. And you could take money out in order to fill that gap, so you'd always have enough, would be the thought or the goal, to pay for 1 year's budget. So you don't have to do the massive cuts that had to occur over the past few years. So that's, I think that pretty much wraps up the whole amendment. The only other part to it is the end, which just says when it's going to go on the ballot.
I have a question back on slide 5, if I may. Could you describe again the distinction between base operations and operations growth in this graph?
Mr. Chairman, base operations just intended to mean the operations that were in effect in 2005 and growing with inflation.
So if I'm understanding correctly, this is sort of a actual operational, the actual op budget is, if you look at black and red combined, and the black is effectively sort of a academic breakout of what pure base budget growth plus inflation would be. Is that right? I didn't describe that very clearly.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The actual spending that occurred in 2005 for agency operations, if you maintain that same level of spending over time, adjusting it for inflation as it moves through time, the black bar represents that same level of service being provided. The red represents actual spending that did occur in excess of that inflation-adjusted amount.
Question. Representative Fields.
What percentage of that was simple growth in the cost of health care?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's a really good question. There is a significant amount of that that is attributable to healthcare. I don't know exactly what that number is, but yes, that is true.
Seeing no further questions, this will be back before committee, but I want to re-note or reinforce the information requests noted previously. And I think, speaking just for myself, I think Representative Ledoux or others had interest. The graph that is effectively on slide 3, seeing that both inflation adjusted and population adjusted, I think would be helpful for me. And if you're sort of so inclined and the administration has an opinion on what the right sort of coefficient to that's not one-to-one, presumably, for population adjustment is appropriate, I'd also be interested in seeing that graph as well. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that graph, well, the one with the base and the growth, yeah, that one. So we talked about population. If you don't know now, maybe you could, you know, what was the per capita income over that time? I know we know what inflation did, but what did average salary do around that time? Income, I guess.
Representative Wolf, through the chair, yes. I do know that both benefits and salaries increased by more than the rate of inflation, and that does have to do with longevity pay and merit pay. Obviously, healthcare has been increasing at faster than the rate of inflation. So those factors are part of what was going on here. I'll try to think about how I might be able to demonstrate the difference between growth in paying current employees versus growth in headcount or something along those lines relative to population. I'll give it a little bit of thought and see what I can come up with.
Thanks.
Representative Vance, last question of the evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep it to one question. What could happen if we don't enact some type of appetite suppressant, such as the spending cap?
Representative Vance, through the chair, I won't speak too, I'll try to be brief. The fear, I guess the biggest fear would be that the government continues to grow faster than the revenues grow, and the easiest outlet would be the savings accounts and the PFD. And so the fear would be that without some kind of limitation on the growth of government, those two things will eventually go away.
Thank you very much. This will be back. I'm going to restate. There will be public testimony for anybody listening online. I'm going to recess to the call of the chair today. It's possible there will be a hearing in this committee on the subject of the permanent fund and ERA to principal transfer with potentially members of the administration and alleged finance and perhaps the permanent fund corp at a time and date to be determined. House Bills 50 and 51 may also be back before this committee. If there's an amendment deadline, that will be communicated by email. And on Tuesday, House Joint Resolutions 5, 6, and 7 have been noticed. You'll notice that it's invited testimony for the reference to the committee. Mr. Vic Fisher might be in town, and he's expressed interest in testifying on the three amendments, and it's our intention to give him that courtesy. And we'll revisit amendments and public testimony at a future date. And I also actually want to re-up in terms of a request to this committee. Representative Ledoux is right. Most of these voicemails I'm getting are not from my district. If you all would like 150 voicemails from people from Washington and California, I'm sure there are outside groups that can arrange that. So I hope this message is taken back to the governor's office. You also might be interested to know a good portion of them, probably half of them, are asking for an income tax. So whatever it is at work is not very effective. So I hope that message is delivered. At 5:03, we're adjourned.